Beanie Conrettos, and welcome again to the Ask Beanie Show. And I know these days, especially with the holidays are not a wonderful time for a lot of people. I've been getting more and more calls from people who are saying, we were hoping that this Hanukkah, this Christmas, this Kwanzaa season was going to be a better year than it was last year, but I'm feeling depressed. I'm still feeling really depressed. And of course, in this country, 1 in 5 Americans are suffering from clinical depression, which translates into 16 million adults in the United States. 40 million adults in this country are suffering from a variety of anxiety disorders. And I think that all of this really does get exacerbated during the holiday time. You know, we have all these childhood wishes and fantasies and hopes and dreams at Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa. We're going to be in love. Our families are going to be close. Our relationships with our children and our siblings and our friends, that things are going to be great. And for a lot of people, this is simply not the case at all. And of course, I tell my patients, look, you know, the holiday season is just one season of the year, Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa, a few days in the month of December. And of course, the real question, you know, then becomes, and I talk about this a lot, I talk about it on the Ask Beanie Show and also with my patients, is what are the lessons that we have learned in the past year? For example, with our depression, what did we actually do to try to alleviate the symptoms of depression? Perhaps our depression has to do with a lot of old issues, unfinished business, or what I call skeletons in the closet, oftentimes, of course, stemming from our family of origin, whether there was abuse of various different kinds, including sexual abuse, sexual assault, verbal abuse, physical or emotional abuse. What did we actually try to do to acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we possibly can what did and did not happen to us when we were growing up? And it's not necessarily, certainly in my experience, it's not about forgiveness necessarily. And you're certainly not going to be able to ever forget what happened to you as a child. But what I have found, and I've been practicing now as a psychotherapist and sex therapist for over 35 years, you know, every week when I say it, I can hardly believe where the past 35 years have actually gone. It's a good thing that in my professional life, I really do love what I do. It is really my passion. But, you know, nonetheless, you know, time is certainly passing by. And as I say to patients who are seeking my advice, hopefully they are serious about following my advice, even though we can't change what happened to us, there is certainly a way. And I have seen this with hundreds and thousands of people that I have treated over the years, to be able to really emotionally process as best as we possibly can the traumas and the pain and the disappointment and the anger, so that we're then able to really live in the present. Maybe not 100%, because we don't forget. And you don't necessarily need to forgive people who have really, really hurt you badly and who've never been able to come to the table and say to you, I am so sorry. Please forgive me. And I want a relationship with you moving forward. And there are many, many things that I am planning to do differently, at least on my part, so that hopefully we can find a way to really reconcile. But these are things that we all need to actually take personal responsibility when it comes to doing. It's not enough to be complaining and to be reminiscing about the past. You know, when we're struggling, whether it's with depression or anxiety or with substance abuse issues of various different kinds, or with our relationships, I mean, people really do need to be willing they need to be serious about stepping up to the plate and doing some work. And I think that there is a fantasy, or maybe there is a hope, that somehow that issues are going to resolve themselves simply by wishing them away or simply by osmosis. And in the real world, my friends, that is not the case. So whether or not we're wanting to get into better physical shape, or whether or not we're really wanting to get into better financial shape, it's not enough to just wish and hope. We have to have a plan. We all need to have a plan. And more than just having a plan, we need to be committed on a daily basis with following through with a daily agenda. You know, I think about athletes, you know, professional athletes. Look what they do to get to the top of their game. It's not enough that they wish to be a great pitcher or they wish to be a great tennis player. The effort, the training, the self-discipline, the coaching that goes into getting to the top of their game, whatever that game may be, takes an enormous amount of discipline and self-discipline, and also coaching. I mean, I look at athletes, as many of you know, I competed in national tennis as a junior, during my entire adolescence. I was actually number 10 in Canada as a junior singles tennis player, and I could never have done this alone. My father was my coach, and there was a really rigorous routine that had to go on so that I would be able to get to, you know, a place where I was winning. And of course, every day I did not win. There were many matches along the road that I lost, but it was always about being committed to staying the course, and when I was off my game, to have someone, and in my life it was my father, to be able to give me advice, to be able to make some adjustments and modifications, and acknowledge, of course, that there were things that need to change. And this is what I have taken from my competitive sports life. I competed in table tennis, I competed in national badminton and skating, and of course tennis. And that has kind of been a ruler for me to be able to measure. And this is something that I try to really convey and to teach my patients, how we need to have a plan, and we need frequently to have a coach, and that we need to be serious about being honest with ourselves and about looking at the kinds of choices that we make on a day-to-day basis, which is why I ask you every week, and I ask my patients after every single session, to think about, as you navigate your days, as you go through your days, whether or not, in fact, you are living your life in a way that is in your best interest. And, you know, we're so harried, and people are so stressed and feeling so stressful oftentimes, that we're on this run where we really don't stop and be introspective and ask ourselves whether or not it is our relationships, whether it is our diet, whether it is our exercise or lack of, whether or not it is a career, to really, really sit down in a quiet place, unencumbered, with our cell phones off and the computers off, and just go through the various different parts of our life. Our money is an example. I was talking to a patient of mine yesterday who was saying that she never looks. She never looks at her balances. She says to me, you know, I'm overspending every single month. And I said, well, you know, what are you going to do about this? She says, well, it's going to work out the way it's going to work out. Well, it probably is not going to work out the way she would like it to work out. So it is about taking responsibility, whether or not we're looking at our money, our income, our savings, our investments, if we're lucky enough to have investments, our debt reduction, our credit. I mean, these are not sexy, fun things that we want to think about. But if we are not financially savvy, we are going to find ourselves in a lot of trouble up the road. So money is something that we need to think about. You know, there was a piece in the New York Times that I talked about last week about careers, to really be honest with oneself. Are you in a career? Are you in a place professionally that is really working for you? Financially, emotionally, does my career really coincide with the kinds of values that I have? And if the answer is yes, that's great. You continue doing exactly what it is that you want to do, which is, in this case, according to what you're saying to yourself, in your best interest. But if it is not, again, what are you going to do about this? Do you need to go back to school? Do you need, maybe even though you can't afford to give up your full-time job, are there courses, not necessarily college courses, are there seminars that you can go to that will help you to clarify perhaps where you would like to be professionally and in your career? Because if we don't sit down with ourselves, and oftentimes with a coach, somebody who you trust, somebody who is knowledgeable in a particular area that you are needing some expertise that you yourself don't have, you just kind of continue to go along on a never-ending roller coaster ride and a never-ending merry-go-round. And of course, you're getting exactly the same results. And then next year in 2020, we're going to be having the same kind of a conversation. But it is not necessary. And these are choices. These are choices that you can make to change in a positive way the direction of your life and the direction of your relationships. Or what about if you're looking at your personal life, your mental growth, your skills, your abilities? Perhaps you need to improve, as we all do, our communication skills and our problem-solving skills. Perhaps it's spiritual growth or emotional growth that you're really feeling that you need to do a little bit of more work on, as we, of course, all do, as we, you know, live our lives. I mean, nobody wants to remain static. The question then, of course, becomes, what is the plan? It's not enough to say, I want. It's not enough to say, I need. It's not enough to say, I'm going to plan. There needs to be a strategy. We need to have some discipline and some self-discipline. And I'm not suggesting that we can do all of these things all at the same time. So it really boils down to prioritizing a couple of things that you would like to tackle that will be in your best interest moving forward in 2020. Or looking at things like free time and family time. You know, I had to see my ophthalmologist this morning. And I asked him, I said, listen, are you planning to take any time off? He said, I don't ever take any time off. Well, that is not a good thing. His practice may be thriving, but what is going on in people's lives when they do not give themselves permission to have some free time, to take some days off, to take some vacations? And we're not talking about extravagant vacations. It really does catch up with us. And these are all things that we need to do to create the life that we want, to create a happy and healthy life. Or what about, you know, health and appearance and weight? Are you committed, for example, to cooking healthily for those people who cook? Are you committed to, instead of just talking about going to the gym, are you committed to going to the gym on a regular basis and making sure that you are exercising regularly so that you're going to then be able to feel better about your body, about your mental status? You're going to feel a lot more attractive. And I hear this a lot, that people will say, well, I should exercise, I should eat better, I should be on a Mediterranean diet. But where is the action? Where is the follow through? And this is something that we can all do a better job with in terms of prioritizing things that are really important and making sure that we follow through, that we take the concerted action that is necessary so that we're going to be able to get to where we say that we really want to go. And what about our relationships? This is a time, of course, where families are getting along. They're going to be spending a lot of time together. But if you look at relationships, your romantic relationships or lack of, your family relationships, your friends, your business, how are they? Are you basically contented where things are at? Or are there things that you need to do? Are there discussions that you need to have? Are there people who you need to confront? And confrontation doesn't need to be done in an angry, miserable, destructive kind of a way, to see whether or not the relationships that you have in your life, you know, can improve. You know, my husband Jim and I, we went to see the movie, the Marriage Story. And of course, the actors, Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, they were really, really incredible. And this was about a couple who, on the surface, their marriage wasn't bad. I mean, they were both very involved in their careers. They were working together as actors. And before we knew it, in the movie, they were actually talking about, and then they subsequently went through the process of getting a divorce. And what was so interesting about the movie was that all of the issues and all of the upset that Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, as a married couple, were feeling about themselves and feeling about their marriage and their relationship, were never, ever, ever discussed, which is why it kind of came as a surprise in the film to see that as they were divorcing, and of course, divorce can be terrible, terrible, depending on how people choose to divorce. I mean, I always talk about, if couples are going to be divorcing, the importance, particularly if they have children, and even if they don't, the importance of divorcing well. But with this particular couple in the movie, their divorce lawyer, I mean, the woman's, Scarlett Johansson's divorce attorney, which was played by Laura Dern, you know, what she was saying to, Scarlett Johansson is, what you're doing, i.e. divorcing, is an act of hope. It's more than simply a line to flatter a potential client. But divorce will require Nicole, which was played by Scarlett Johansson, and her soon-to-be ex-husband, Adam Driver, to participate, and this was encouraged by her divorce attorney, in a legal process that is artificial and estranging by nature, calling on them to make cartoon villains of each other. And this is the way the script was written. But the wrongness of that process is distinct from the rightfulness of its result. Now, maybe they needed to get a divorce. Perhaps they didn't have really good marital therapy. It showed in the film that they had a couple of sessions, and I wasn't particularly impressed with the marriage counselor. But the way it ended was that they finally got to a place where they were able to, I think, respect each other and like each other. And, of course, they were sharing a child. And there was a song that was played at the end, Becoming Alive, Sondheim's musical company. And, okay, maybe they needed to feel alive by getting a divorce. But there are ways in our relationships, particularly if people are going to be going through the process of divorce. Hopefully people have actually learned something. They've learned something from the marriage. And in this particular situation, like with the majority of couples that I work with, the communication and the problem-solving skills are almost completely, completely absent. And, you know, I was saying to my husband, Jim, I wonder what would have happened if these two people had had some really good counseling and they were able to express their upsets and their discontent and their anger and their disappointments. And maybe she thought that he was too controlling, and maybe he felt that she was too passive, to be able to get it all out. And this is where discussion and compromise and trade-offs, looking and working toward a win-win resolution, is the name of the game for all of us, whether or not we're talking about romantic relationships or whether we're talking about our marriages or our working relationships. People certainly need to be doing a much, much better job in honing the skills, in getting the skills, so that we're able to, as things start to unfold, and in all relationships, even in the best relationships, there are always going to be issues. There are always going to be problems. But I think that generally speaking, people are really reluctant. And I think that they're reluctant because they are generally ill-equipped to deal with problems, which is why I've been saying this for so many years, why relationship education is something that is so important for all of us. Because if we don't deal, not only is it going to affect our relationships, it's going to affect our physical health and our mental health. And in this particular, you know, movie, I wondered, you know, when the movie was over, whether or not the couple, Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver, in the roles that they were playing, whether they actually really learned something positive that would help them moving forward as a result of their divorce. And of course, you know, when I talk about relationships, perhaps the choice was not a good choice initially. And this is where people need to be in a good place themselves emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically, so that they're very, very clear about the kind of relationships that they are looking for, that they're feeling good about themselves, that they're not looking for somebody to rescue them. The damsel is looking for the king in the night, you know, to rescue the damsel in distress. And again, I think what is so important is that we are clear, that we are really, really clear about the ingredients that actually do go into healthy long-term relationships. And then, of course, I talk about this every single week, the importance of really learning how to assess who is right for you and who is wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship, which is, of course, what my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, is all about. But if we're looking at our relationships, I want you to think about your relationship bill of rights. because there are some fundamental measures that need to be present if our relationships are really going to work. You know, for example, despite the fact that everybody is so busy these days, you have the right to your partner's attention. And your partner's attention is likely to improve your satisfaction with a relationship, whether it's spontaneous, like an unexpected afternoon text that makes you smile. I know that really makes my day. I'll be going throughout my day. I may be seeing patients or running around. And there is a text from Jim. Just, hey, I'm thinking about you. I love you. Wow, does that make a difference in my day? And this is something that we can all do. It doesn't cost anything. It is not expensive. And it makes all the difference in the world. You know, for example, there was a 2017 study on relationship experiences published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that on the days when their partners had supported them or said something that made them feel loved, people understandably reported higher relationship quality. So it is these little things that really do make a difference. And for example, you have the right to a partner who will try to work out your differences. And this is why, as unsexy and as unromantic as communication skills and problem-solving skills are, these are the two ingredients up the road that will really make or break your relationship. Because, you know, as I've been saying, all long-term relationships and also short-term relationships encounter some spots and conflicts around, you know, that it could be the smallest little things. But ignoring these small little problems will not make them go away, even if partners do so because they sincerely don't want to pick a fight. So denying and avoiding and putting your issues and your upset and your anger and your frustration and your pain under a carpet or in the drawer, it is not going to help you. It is not going to solve the problem. It is not going to help your relationship. And the reality is that no relationship can thrive when two parties hold in frustrations that need to be shared and resolved. And I think that the majority of couples, I would say that the vast majority of couples that I've worked with over the years, they all agree that they just didn't quite know how to do it well. And what happens, of course, is that the pot is going to boil over eventually. I mean, there's going to be huge disruptions. There may be divorce, there may be affairs, and this is why it's the small little things that need to be dealt with as they come up, and that you're not going to wait 10 years or 5 years or 1 year or 6 months, so that when you're finding that things are really starting to get off track, when you're finding that you're feeling sad and disconnected, that is the time to say to your partner, listen, honey, there's some things that I really do want to talk to you about, and that's pick a time. And this may sound a little contrived, but it is not, because it works. And to be able to express, and of course it's finding the words and the way and the time to be able to do this well, which is exactly what happens in really effective marital therapy. I know that when I'm working with couples, I have a his agenda and a her agenda, if it happens to be a heterosexual couple. And we don't go to the second agenda item until the first item is dealt with and discussed. And hopefully the couple are able to then get to a win-win resolution. And addressing problems as they arise. And of course, all the studies show this, improves spouses' psychological well-being and ratings of marital quality or relationship quality, especially for women. But I think not just especially for women, I think for men as well. I mean, men also want to have good, safe, loving relationships, emotional relationships. It's not just about the women. And one study, and this was an interesting study, of 205 married couples found that wives who believed that their husbands did more emotional work were more satisfied with their relationships. Of course, not to be surprised with that finding. And once differences are out in the open, even those that might have seemed irreconcilable in one's imagination, you know, we sometimes think, well, this is never going to work out. This will never be resolved. Well, we can never assume that. Can often be addressed with a compromise or a conscious agreement to disagree. It's okay to be able to say, listen, honey, I agree to disagree with you. And yet we can continue in our relationship and I can love you, but I certainly would have handled the situation differently. So yes, I agree that we are going to disagree on this particular issue. And you also have the right to a partner who's going to share the load. And this is a right that's really well worth defending, in part because it appears to deliver significant benefits to both partners. So what do some of the studies have to say about this? Well, sharing housework is associated with greater feelings of fairness, teamwork, and overall relationship quality. In particular, feelings of teamwork, communication, cooperation, and shared vision are important to sexual intimacy, certainly for women, okay? So this, and if you find that your partner is not carrying his or her load, you're not going to want to wait years to communicate this. And this is where, when things arise, to be able to say, listen, I feel that I am carrying the lion's share of the household work, or I'm carrying the lion's share of parenting, and we need to find a better way to divvy all of this up. So it is a conversation. You're not blaming your partner. You're always hopefully looking to see whether or not resolutions and compromises and trade-offs are going to be possible, regardless of whether or not we're talking about parenting or whether or not we are talking about housework. And here's another area. You have the right to honesty about sex. So what are partners entitled to in the bedroom? So the answer is going to vary from couple to couple. But the research finds that it's not necessarily the presence or absence of sexual activity, a specific schedule or frequency, or even the pleasure derived from it, that is most associated with relationship satisfaction. So what matters, according to some of the studies, is that both partners' expectations, whatever they are are met. So that's why two people can sincerely find satisfaction in a sexless relationship. And that is only, of course, if neither expects sex nor seeks it, its absence doesn't affect how they feel about each other. But sexual expectations can and do change over time. And it's crucial for a couple's satisfaction that partners communicate shifts in both their desire and their capability. And if you're looking at sexless marriages, even with people who are older, and of course, you've heard me mention that when I lived in Sarasota, I treated a lot of older people, and there were women in their 70s and 80s who had far more active sex lives than many, many people that I treated in their 40s and 50s. And that was something that was really important to these men and to these women. But if you're in a sexless relationship, and of course, if both people feel okay about that, I still think it's important, since sex is an important part. It is a natural instinct that we all have, to at least talk about it and to discuss. Why is it here we are, we're in our 30s or 40s or whatever age, and why do you think it is, darling, that we no longer have sex? What's changed? In the beginning of our relationship, we were sexually active, and I just want to check it out with you and find out what has changed for you. And I will let you know what has changed for me. Maybe it was depression or some psychiatric issue, depression or anxiety or sexual abuse that had never been dealt with that somehow found its way into the bedroom years after the couple got together or the couple married. But I think that it really requires an honest discussion to at least touch base with your partner and see whether or not you're still feeling okay enough about living in a sexless relationship. Perhaps it was giving birth to a child. And of course, you know, for those of us, you know, who have children, we understand that it is all consuming, especially if you have a young child. But looking the other way and denying and avoiding the issues are not going to be helpful long term. So I think it's really important, you know, even for people who are living in sexless marriages or for people who are having sex very, very infrequently, to at least have the conversation and see what it is that's going on. And maybe you want to start slowly. Maybe you want to have a plan and you want to make a date for sex and just kind of try it on for size and maybe go out for dinner and try and have a romantic evening and see whether or not there is interest on both parts. And maybe there's going to be interest, you know, with just one of the individuals to see whether or not there is a desire. And if there is a desire, then to find a way to try to reconnect sexually. I mean, I found over the years that very, very, very few couples that I have treated, even though they may be living in basically sexless marriages, are really okay about living in sexless marriages. So I think it's about finding a time to talk about the issues, whether or not it's about sex or anything else. And for some, it might be, well, you know, relaxing in bed, a setting that can lead to openness and honesty and intimacy, and try to see, you know, where things may have really gotten off track. You know, for example, an opening sentence might be, I have a few thoughts about our sex life, and I would like to be able to discuss it with you. And hopefully your partner is going to be willing, because it's obviously been a dicey subject that has not been discussed for months and for many, many people for years. And, you know, one never knows, you know, what can actually come about if you are willing to acknowledge and address and resolve the issue, whatever that issue is, as best as you can. I mean, maybe, you know, there were the psychiatric issues, the depression or the anxiety. Maybe there's something else going on in the relationship that the people have never been able or willing to talk about. Perhaps there's some physical problems. There was a heart attack. There was a stroke. There was the birth of a child. Maybe there's been pain for the woman when she's had intercourse in the past. And instead of, you know, really dealing with it directly with the doctor or with her spouse, that she just may have assumed that, well, I guess that's it for my sex life. And that does not necessarily have to be the case at all. Perhaps, like many, many people that I have seen over the years, that they are suffering from the sexual side effects of a variety of different medications, over-the-counter medications, prescription medications. You know, when is the last time that you were given a prescription from your doctor and the doctor said to you, listen, Mrs. So-and-so or Miss So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so, this medication has been shown to have serious sexual side effects, and I want you to be aware of that. And perhaps there's another medication that we might try if you're finding that the medication that I'm now prescribing is affecting you sexually in any way. And I think that's something that happens very, very rarely, where the subject of sex, period, is ever discussed with a physician. You know, and I've said this to you over the years, there has never been a time when I have seen my internist or when I would see, and even currently when I have a wonderful, wonderful gynecologist, nobody has ever asked me whether or not I had a good sex life or a bad sex life. The subject of sex has never in all of these years ever been raised. So this is where, as a consumer, we need to be really very proactive. And if we are concerned, maybe we don't know what it is that's really going on. Maybe it's not about depression and it's not about the relationship. And yet we don't understand. We don't understand why it is that we have no sex drive, no sexual desire whatsoever. And I think that if we're going to be waiting, certainly in my professional experience and in personal experience, for doctors to raise this issue, we may be waiting a very, very long time. So that I really do encourage you, and I think that sex is important in a relationship. I really do encourage you to, first of all, have the discussion with your partner, and then definitely, you know, have a consultation with your medical doctor just to, you know, make sure that you're ruling out anything physical that may be going on. And if that doesn't give you any important information or information of any kind, then I would strongly, strongly suggest that you see a qualified therapist and somebody who is also a qualified sex therapist with all of the necessary credentials. and explore what it is that's been going on. And you may find that your answer is a simple answer. It just may be that you just no longer prioritize sex in your life, and that with some few little changes in your relationship, you might find that you're going to be able to get you and your partner back on track sexually. So think about that. And also in your relationship, of course, you have the right to affection. Affection. Because sexual passion may wane, okay, and it certainly does wax or wane over time in any long-term relationship. But it's really important that affection carry on. And giving and receiving affection is associated with feelings of pleasure and acceptance and happiness or contentment and a sense of being loved or cared for. And, you know, research studies have found, and of course we don't need the research studies to tell us this, but research has found that hearing "I love you" and receiving physical affection outside of sexual intercourse, among other behaviors, predicts higher marital satisfaction, and I would say relationship satisfaction, for both men and women. And, you know, a lot of people say to me, well, how do I get this? Well, if you don't ask, you don't get. So according to this one researcher, of course, asking for it, and you can start by giving more affection to your partner. And once your partner sees you giving more affection to them, they may reciprocate. And if they don't, you do need to have the discussion and say something, not "you never touch me" or "you're never affectionate," but to say, "I love it. Do you know, I love it when you hold my hand. I love it when you put your arm around me. And I love it when we kiss. And I think that maybe, honey, we need to spend a lot more time being affectionate with each other. It makes me feel so much closer to you." Now, putting it in that way, rather than saying, "You're never affectionate. I don't know why I married you. I don't know why I'm with you." I mean, that kind of a pattern of communication is going to absolutely get you nowhere. It's going to get you to have a partner that is more and more resentful and that is more and more disconnected with you. And you can try to arrange more opportunities for affection by planning relaxed time together, turning off the cell phones, turning off the computers, getting a babysitter for your children so that the two of you are going to have sufficient adult time together. I mean, that's one of the things too, you know, when people have young children and even older children, it's so often that the children really become the priority in the family. And this is something that I have been saying, and I've been saying to you for years and years, about the importance, regardless of the fact that we know that young children need an enormous amount of time and attention, the importance of really trying to keep the couple at the top of the list of priorities. Otherwise, it's just so easy. It's just so easy for the couple to get lost in the maze, the work, the debt, everything that is required in today's, you know, very fast-paced, frenzied life. And this is why people have to remind themselves. You know, you think about it. When we were dating, look at the time and look at the energy that we spent in really trying to be attractive and feel attractive, you know, when we were with our partners. And I think that people, they become overwhelmed. And I think at times we can all become a little bit lax and lazy, and then we wonder why we are feeling so disconnected, you know, from our partner. And this is why, unlike what happened in the movie Marriage Story, where they just didn't talk, and then all of a sudden they were getting a divorce. So there were years and years that went by where important issues and also unimportant issues were not talked about, and we're asking for trouble if we allow that to happen. And there was something in this article in Psychology Today, you know, looking at your relationship bill of rights, that I thought was really interesting. And this one was, you have the right to the benefit of the doubt. Okay? Relationships flourish when couples attribute the best of intentions to each other all the time. I mean, this may not always be the way it's working, and your partner may not have meant to do the very best toward you at a given time. But the studies do show that if you really try to believe that your partner is doing the best for you, or the best that he or she is able to do at that given moment and given time, that it really does make a big difference. And this means that, yes, your partner really should view you through rose-colored glasses, not all the time, okay? Idealizing you in normal circumstances and forgiving you relatively easily when you fall short. So a little bit of positive illusion is better. And relationship satisfaction typically starts falling, and this is interesting, immediately after a couple says, "I do." But many studies have pointed toward a prescription for sustaining it. In just one recent example, this is a professor, Sandra Murray of the University at Buffalo, found that partners who continue to idealize their spouse, even somewhat unrealistically, experienced less decline in satisfaction with the marriage over 3 years than people who cannot maintain the same belief. You know, it's interesting, and you know, you kind of wonder, so how do you get there? How do you get it? Well, we have a lot of latitude in how we perceive our partner's behavior. So for example, if you show up late to an appointment event, your partner could label you inconsiderate, or remember that you've been overwhelmed at work but are still trying to get everything done. And again, it's how we are going to deal with a situation. For example, and this is a little thing, but it's important, if you're going to be late. These days, there is no reason at all to not send a text and say, "Listen, I'm going to be 5 minutes late, or I'm going to be 10 minutes late. I just wanted you to know, basically, that I cared enough about you and I cared enough about your feelings to let you know so that you were not going to have to wait and you were not going to have to wonder what happened." These little things really make all the difference in the world. And then you have the right to gratitude. Partners who are grateful for each other, studies have shown, feel more satisfied in their relationships. And even when just one partner feels gratitude, whether on an existential level or for simple things like being brought a favorite drink, both benefit. So if you start doing nice things, your partner picks up on it and feels appreciated. It should inspire things, and it should inspire their own good feelings. Gratitude can increase people's motivation to staying in and improve a relationship, and make them more likely excuse me, to engage in more considerate behaviors like better listening and sacrificing for their partner. So when is the last time that you said to your partner, you know what, I'm really grateful. I'm really grateful for us. I'm really grateful for you. Because a recent psychological study also found that it's the feeling of gratitude that makes a difference, not the acts that engender it. Of course, the acts in themselves are also very important as well, because that people who are likely to notice a partner's sacrifice is not, and they are just as likely to see a sacrifice when there is none as they are to correctly note its absence. So that we have to be conscious. And good relationships do not just happen on their own. So whether or not we're talking about romantic relationships or family relationships, we need to make a concerted effort to do the very, very best that we can do on a daily basis. And if we are running into difficulties, that we are not going to ignore the difficulties, and we are going to do everything possible to acknowledge and address and resolve the problems as best as they can be resolved. And that's what happy couples do. That's what happy families do. And I have every confidence that that is also what you can do moving forward in the new year. So everybody, another hour has come and gone here on the Ask Beauty Show. And I want to thank you so much for listening and for tuning in and for going to the Ask Beauty archives here on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have my two weekly messages that I want to leave you with. The first one, of course, is that I want you to make a concerted effort every single day to do whatever it is that you can possibly do to love yourself and to be mindful about doing things that are really in your best interest.